This is On Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, Dutch architect Winnie Maas shares his thoughts on merging architecture with the natural world, Monocle's fashion director Marcella Palik on Milan Fashion Week, plus we hear how George Jensen continues to innovate in the field of well-crafted silverware. All that and more coming up right here on Design. Do stay tuned. Dutch architect Winnie Maas co-founded MVRDV in 1993, a practice where his Naus and green ambitions have combined to see designs of sustainable housing and office buildings and many cultural institutions realized. His latest work, Boymans van Beuninga, an art depot in his native Rotterdam, was completed just last week. It's currently being filled with art and will open to the public next year. Maas sat down with this show's researcher Nick Manise to talk about the project and how it has been informed by MVRDV's research-driven approach.
We need to start with a lot of your work centres around merging architecture with the natural world. How do you build this into your process for each project?
I am aware that it's not the only agenda point in our ambition to for the future city. I mean, I am aware that the social agenda or the economical agenda or the social economical agenda is also very important in its widest terms. But this green ambition is one of those what I call pieces of the bucket list that is important. That has a lot of, again, subtitles also, this green agenda. And it has to deal also with finance and possibilities and culture and what can you achieve at what moment. But and it ranges, say, from actively try to make more plants wherever possible, actively deal with water storage as much as possible, but also with the, natural, say, building materials that are needed in our built environment. It means that I cannot achieve everything in every building.
With that in mind, what green agenda were you able to include in the new art depot in Rotterdam?
In the case of the depot, to one of a super green roof with, a fat package of soil for the water storage and the trees on top, including the windscreen that is needed to protect them. There is an enormous effort in this case for a heavy building to shrink the footprint of the building, which just leads to this kind of taille that you can see in the building, so that the impact, therefore, on the park around is a little bit reduced. Also that the interference in the water system in Rotterdam is reduced in that way, while combining with all the functionalities of a depot. So that's the second part of the operation. The third one is, and that's a very visual one, is the mirroring of the environment. So to do a visual, say, contribution towards the park and also now to the city as such. I'm aware that it strengthens certain other kind of aspects in the green agenda. And that's why it's good to mention that these three elements that this building specifically contribute to. We had to use concrete. We could reduce certain kind of cements to make it more green, but this was not doable yet in wood, for instance, as a building, or even in a natural rubber, which I would try to do. So there's you come to limits and to a moment in time where you can achieve within the budgets and within the economy that's there and within the technical situation of these days, what we can achieve.
Beyond just an architecture studio, MVRDV is also a publishing house and a think tank, I guess thanks to your work with the Y Factory. How does this influence your studio's actual practice?
So the research at the Y Factory, it's a think tank. It's has its main siege in Delft, the Technical University of Delft. It is teaching master students on the future city as such. That's our program, and that leads to different researches on components for that future city, both in a hyper holistic way, the overview of all these elements, as in partial ways. For instance, the study of sky cars, what the effect would be on urbanism, is one, mini research within that. Or the Green Dip is coming out soon as a book and as a software where like the full coverage of our built environment by trees and by products that serve those trees has been calculated and has been explored and has been calculated not only in terms of money, but also in terms of maintenance or in terms of how much it gives to the city in oxygen, in water storage and in cooling. I think the Y Factory is a good think tank for us also to make this shopping list of what is needed to make, say, this hypergreen building or hypergreen environment. And then you need to apply that on the given situations that are there and see what is possible out of that list. That's what happens. We are currently in the office to make, say, our green agenda. This is a holistic part, you can say, is to make that actually more applicable in the widest sense within our own, say, research group in the office, to apply that on like systems like Briam or LEED, or say the, which are the practical components of our practice when you build and design in many countries. And to have that holistic component as dredged into that, but that we do that in the office then. And the Y Factory is more for the longer term.
I mean, I guess through your work with the Y Factory and with MVRDV, you've also completed a lot of projects in Rotterdam. I mean, how has your practice helped to shape the city?
There are more cities where we somehow have a relation with, where because of being there, because of having more work and more commissions and also more like knowledge about the area and collaborating with different people, that we can establish tests for this agenda. That sometimes it helps with a project where we haven't been before, that comes in also there. Then in Rotterdam, of course, very clearly living here or working here mainly, is having our headquarters here with maybe now a certain reputation that we also can suggest things. But it's relationships with cities that do give a more insight and more a profound way of developing bigger agendas.
Our thanks to Winnie Mass there. He was speaking to Monocle's Nick Manise. Now, let's catch up with this week's key design events and releases that you can't miss, and the most important industry news from Monocle's Maylee Evans.
First to Chinese megacity Chongqing, where the latest phase of Safety Architects' vast urban renewal project on the historic Chao Tianmen Square waterfront has opened. This most recent milestone is the unveiling of a landscaped public observatory with a glass-bottom open-air viewing deck in the Crystal, a horizontal skyscraper that spans 4 towers and is 300 metres long. The full project, which encompasses 8 towers and 30,000 square metres of public space, is due to be fully operational by the end of 2020. In other architectural news, Copenhagen's largest hospital, the Rigshospitalet, has opened its innovative North Wing extensions. Designed in a zigzag shape inspired by a cardiogram, this unique approach allows for a central artery to ease flow through the hospital, whilst allowing for quiet space, natural light, and privacy for patients. It's a great example of a creative idea that has clear and relevant applications to the building's use. Next, it's a short trip over to Sweden, where environmentally conscious clothing brand Ascot is now issuing an impact receipt with its items. Putting many fast fashion brands to shame, the company now provides a breakdown of the environmental impact of each item, including metrics like CO2, water use, and energy consumption. The brand is already well known for its transparency efforts. Clothes also arrive accompanied by a price breakdown that details the cost of raw materials, fabric production, labour, and markup. Back to you, Nolan.
Thanks to Maylee Evans there with some highlights from this week's design news. For more, subscribe to our Monocle on Design newsletter, which hits inboxes every Wednesday. After a number of fashion shows were cancelled earlier this year, Milan's Fashion Week, which wrapped up on Thursday, was a welcome change from digital events for designers and fashion enthusiasts. To learn about new trends that emerged at the event, I sat down with Monocle's very own style director, Marcella Palik.
So I'm very happy to speak to you today, Marcella. You have been in Milan for the Fashion Week, which is, you know, a super rare thing this year. So can you firstly just tell us about your experience, what it was like there?
So actually, at the Fashion Week in Milan, exactly 1 year ago, it was just as pleasantly mild, the light was just as golden as is typical for this time of year in Milan. On the Via Monte Napoleone, certain sought-after handbags were completely sold out at that time, even in light blue and orange, the colors that are otherwise difficult to sell in the luxury segment. But this year, there is noticeably less fashion crowd, influencers and tourists crowding the fashion mile. The shelves of the shops are full, so the autumn collections are waiting for their customers.
How is that as an experience for someone that needs to go there for work? You know, you're a style editor. I imagine when you're kind of having to push through crowds to even see something, it can be difficult. So is it actually more of a pleasant experience this year?
I mean, it's both sides. Of course, it's pleasant if you have enough space on the streets, on the tiny streets, the bars and cafes. But at the same time, you know, it's so important for Milan, for the economics and for all the brands. So you have two sides. But I think as a tourist, you will enjoy it because you have space enough in the bars and restaurants. And if you love Milan, then you will find the same Milan as usual, just with the chic, cool Italians wearing their mascherini. They wear it as elegantly like their sunglasses.
Well, you're painting a really lovely picture of the scene there, but we should maybe get to the fashion. So what did you actually see? Were you able to go to any real shows?
Yes, there was everything. There were fashion shows, physical, there were digital ones, and they were also phygital, which means physical and digital both at the same time. So actually, I saw a fashion show and there wasn't as many fashion people around as usually. So it was quite nice to go there. But of course, then it lacks this special electric atmosphere that you usually find. Also, don't forget, a fashion show is one thing, but there is also the social show. This you never can transfer digitally. This means all the editors, influencers, buyers dressed up, very chic, chatting to each other. I think this is so important for the atmosphere of a fashion show. And this never can be digitally transferred.
I received a text from you, kind of, I guess, mid-Milan. And you said that Santoni Women's Shoe Collection was a good one. So can you maybe share a bit of information about that?
Yeah, so Santoni is very famous for the classic, very well-made, high-quality men's shoes. Now they did a brand new capsule collection with the designer, which is really, really amazing. A completely new Santoni. I'm very excited and I would love to have it in one of our fashion shootings.
Well, that's very exciting to know that we've got some new shoes for the new pages of Monocle. But just finally, I guess going there as an editor, do you feel like you got enough? Do you feel like you were maybe still missing something? Like you were saying before, the digital aspect makes things a little bit colder and less social. Was there enough there? Would you be advising fashion editors to make their way to the next shows?
Yes, of course, because if you don't go there, you will miss a lot. So Italy and Milan does everything to make their city as attractive as possible. So, for example, you can find for the next 2 weeks at the Rinascente, the big department stores at the Dome of Milan, you will find in the windows young upcoming Italian designers. And that's really fantastic, the opportunity they get to get visible in those big, huge windows of Rinascente. And this is, of course, something very nice. And it's, of course, difficult to find online somewhere.
And just for me, because I'm going to be heading to Milan because they're doing a design week, you mentioned before, you know, the stylish, good-looking people on the streets of Milan. Do you think I'm going to have a nice experience there? Do you think Milan is a place people really should be visiting right now, people that are interested in design?
Yes, of course. They do their Design City Milan thing, and there are many, many things, and also bars and every stores trying to do their best to be attractive, to show new things. The bars have their tables outside and are really creative to make something out of the city. So I think you will enjoy it a lot.
Thanks, Marcella. That was Monocle's style director speaking to us from Zurich. Let's hear from our sponsors, Wizug, titans in Switzerland for their offerings in fine home appliances. They're now looking to grow their offering on a broader international scale. Let's hear from Marcel Niederberger, head of sustainability at Wizug, on what sustainability means for the company.
I think it's important to scope the term sustainability. What do we understand behind that? And we do that classically in the triple bottom line. That means we want to take care on people, planet and profit all at the same importance. Not as often company do that in the past, just having the profit or loss on the bottom line. We want to have that equal. Why is this important to the company? We strongly believe that's one of the main aspects, the reason why we can exist. We do household appliances in the center of Switzerland. We don't do the low end of the pricing range. So we have to have the triple bottom line really in our heart to also afford the price and also the activities that we do. A very important role model that we use right now is the circular economy. This gives us the model to really have a look at our business model. You can imagine here in Switzerland, the raw material comes in on a steel coil, and at the end of the factory, a fully fledged washing machine comes out of the fabrication, but it doesn't end there. It's very important what happens afterwards on the consumer side. Our appliances are usually in use 15 to 20 years at the customer side, so it's very important how effective and efficient our appliances are. But it doesn't stop at the end of life at the consumer side. It then leads to collecting the appliances, refurbish, upcycling potentially the appliances, and recycle them, and closing the loop then again. Often if you talk about sustainability or environment, people think, I'm the only one, I can't really change something because it's just myself. And that's true, it's just yourself, but you are just one out of, let's take Switzerland as an example, 3.8 million households. So if everyone would do that in the right way, and we made some internal calculations, if all the households in Switzerland would use their appliances in an ecological way, opening the door of the fridge not too long, filling the washing machine completely, using eco programs, having a cover on the pot when heating up water, all this calculated together, we came up with one nuclear power plant could be shut down in Switzerland. So it has an impact. Even if you think, I personally myself, it doesn't really make a difference, but it makes a difference, definitely. Just to give you one example, which in my opinion is a very good example how Wizug acts in terms of repairability. Next year, a regulation will change here in Europe, and all the manufacturers have to provide spare parts for 10 years. When the last appliance leaves our factory, you can still buy spare parts after 15 years. So something that we have done for decades already, just beside our own motivation, because we thought that's just true. An appliance on that price range needs to be able to be repaired. Now it gets a must for all the manufacturers. And we never really talked about that. It was just we thought we do that because it's the right thing. Whenever I explain sustainability and what that means, I always say we don't have to invite something new because there is a global agenda out there. It's the UN Sustainable Development Goals introduced 2015, primarily thinking towards politics and countries, but it's getting more and more clear that the private sector plays a very important role in fulfilling that agenda. And we want to take responsibility there as well and see how we can do our bit and how can we align our engagement towards the Sustainable Development Goal.
My thanks to Marcel Niederberger, Head of Sustainability at Wizug. Finally on today's show, the Danish makers of fine silverware, Georg Jensen, are renowned for their craftsmanship. With a treasure trove of an archive that spans 100 years, one question that springs to mind is how, with such a rich legacy to follow, do you continue to innovate? To answer this and more, I spoke to the company's chief creative officer, Nicholas Manville.
We have four distinct product categories. So we have watches, jewelry, we have home collection, and then we have our silver hollowware, which is really the halo of the entire company. So I'll talk about that one because it's almost a symbol of what the whole company is. We have heritage of making things by hand in Copenhagen. So we still have a smithy operating here, almost in the same way as it did when it started in 1904. And that same idea of working that way is things we try to translate across every product category. So we have a dedication to craftsmanship for sure. We have this history. We have an archive here as well. We let that be the foundation of how we evolve. So we're always trying to use the archive to propel us forward. It's not a dusty place. It's a space we use all the time in the creative process. You can touch the drawings. You can handle the silver. It's not this precious, untouchable museum. It's something we really do work with and try and twist all the time. And we apply that sensibility to each of the categories that we work in.
And would you say that's a particularly Danish approach, even though, you know, what you're creating is very beautiful and very delicate? Maybe the approach to the creation is a bit more, you know, down to earth, a bit more humble. How does Denmark reflect itself in your company?
The whole Scandinavian ideas around the simplicity of things, the cleanliness of lines, we don't really have adorned products. If there's a design element in a product, it's usually the place where you're going to touch it or use it. So it would be the handle of a pitcher where you really see, or the spout where it looks a bit unique. But it's focusing on really simple details. The overall appearance becomes simple, but to get it that way, it takes a lot of work. So I wish, sometimes with our steel products, I wish that people knew just how hard they are to make and how much goes into them, because it looks like such a machined material, but it's a lot of handwork that goes into something like that.
But I imagine kind of behind the scenes, you know, in your role, but also when you're approaching a designer to come and work with you, there must just be such a great allure to that. There must be, you know, an instant like, wow, when these people walk into the workshop. What's that experience like?
Well, whenever we decide to work with a designer, the first place we take them is the archive. So I guess we do try to wow them a little bit. We want them to not be overly in awe of us, but to be inspired by us, so that they feel comfortable enough twisting our language and taking us to a place that we wouldn't ask to go ourselves because we don't know. So it's important that they bring something of themselves into their work with us, and we want them to feel free to express themselves without too much baggage, but to really come up with a product that or a design that works for both of us. It's not theirs and it's not ours. It's something that would only happen together.
And I think that's such a lovely way to put it, twisting our language. I mean, it's not something you hear too many kind of design directors saying about a brand, but why is that important and what value have you kind of got from doing that so far?
Well, I think we live with this archive and this history all of the time, and it's just in our DNA and how we work. And it's sometimes nice for someone else to tell you how you are than for us to live a world where we're thinking we know everything about ourselves. So it's also been interesting lately what we work with people around the world. It's interesting to have Scandinavia reflected back onto us, because sometimes the values change of what people think Scandinavian values are in other parts of the world. And the slight variations between what we think of it and what they think of it has kind of a nice tension to it.
It's kind of a great segue to the collaboration we're talking about today, because you are working with an architecture and design firm that's not from Denmark. But what were their thoughts when they were kind of trying to articulate what they thought was interesting about your brand, or maybe what was Danish about your brand? Back to you.
The real difference between us and Snoetta was that they are primarily an architecture company, so the scale is a completely different thing. So I think for us, who are more in the business of making objects, and they're in the business of making landscapes, basically, and how you play with that scale was the interesting thing with them. So it wasn't so much the culture, it was more the two disciplines coming together. We may not have done a world of plants or had this idea about plants unless we'd worked with them, because there's a lot of these things out there in the world, and unless we had a different language to speak about it, it wasn't worth doing. We thought that maybe they could bring that to us, because they're very contextual in how they work. It's not just the building, it's the landscape. And so finding someone who would work with landscapes was sort of the appeal, and could play with scale with us, so that it could be indoor and outdoor, and kind of have this vision of these objects sitting in a context of a building as opposed to a shelf. So that was kind of the fun of working with them, is figuring that out, how we would do that.
I'm also interested in, I guess, these kind of precious objects are also filled with soil, which I think is interesting too. So I'd love to hear a bit about that dynamic. But perhaps if you could outline the name and where it came from and how it relates to what you were just talking about.
Yeah, the name actually came later in the process. So it was basically the last thing that happened. It was more figuring out how we would work and what materials we would use. And I think Snoeta was rather captivated by the hardness of steel and the earthiness of the terracotta and what each would do for a plant. Everything kind of came back to an idea of reflections. So the pieces are asymmetrical, but when a plant is in them, they become symmetrical. So it's reflecting the roots and the plant one way. And then the steel is very polished, so that also reflects the terracotta. You don't see a lot of vessels for plants that are super shiny and dazzling, but it's almost a mirror effect to the plant itself. So it takes on the color of the leaves and things like that. So all of these reflection ideas were very, very cool. But the earth part, we never really worked with that material at all. So it was interesting to apply the design to something as precise as steel and something as malleable as clay. To have them look the same shape with totally different ways of working was a challenge for us and a good one. We had asked for it. So we wanted to work with a new material. So we did end up figuring it out. And at the end, just because of the colors and what the collection was about and the going way back to fundamental ideas about what is a plant and how we live with them, it's just the connection to the earth. And that is Terra. So that's how we came upon that name.
It sounds like you covered a lot of ground. One thing that's so interesting about that company is their emphasis on, you know, just doing things better for the planet. And I guess we're in Copenhagen and you're, you know, one of the bigger design companies here. What are you guys doing, I guess, around sustainability and how important is it for you guys going forward? Because you do have such a big international reach. You're not just for Denmark or even just for Europe.
There's basic ways, of course, packaging and these types of things that you can approach it with, the materials in your store that you use for building, and all of those are things we pay attention to. But I think the biggest thing that matters to us is we're not a fashion company. So we kind of work with the idea that everything's permanent. We don't have collections that come in and out. And when you buy something from us, the quality that we're using with the steel and all of these subtle techniques I described before make it last forever if you want it to. So it's not disposable items, and they tend to have a function for everyday use. So it's something we hope people will live with for a very long time. And I guess there's this this balance about sustainability for things you use quickly and sustainability for things you use for decades, and where that balance is and what the right equation is around all of that. And so, of course, we have to figure that out. We don't make things to be thrown away, that is for sure. And everything's meant to be permanent. We are lucky in that we have a body of work that we can, we have a century plus of work that we can kind of rotate in and out of because we've done so many different styles in the past that we can revisit things that we've already done a little more easily than I think other companies can because we've been established for so long.
That was Nicholas Manville there, Chief Creative Officer of Georg Jensen. And sadly, that's all the time we have on today's show. But if you're keen for more design stories, you can listen to our 5-minute midweek sister show on Design Extra, which airs every Thursday. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylie Evans. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.